Brigadier Daniel, Reel 8. I'd like to ask you a bit about your conditions of service there. What sort of food would you get, and who would prepare it for you?
I fed with Colonel Seeley and his headquarters in a tent. The cook I considered completely and absolutely useless, and he very seldom washed, and he was an objectionable asset to life.
Was this Vic Jones, Sergeant Vic Jones?
No, I don't know who he was. I don't smell like that.
And what food would you get then? What would you get for breakfast?
Don't ask me. I've no idea.
You don't remember that sort of thing?
No. I ate a certain amount of what we got. I didn't care for it. Cigarettes became very short. And so short that at a later date you would spend anything up to 5 or 6 hours digging in the sand where you knew you'd thrown away a couple of cigarettes.
So the ones sent in by your wife were precious to you?
Very, very precious.
What about water? I mean, did you run short of water?
Now, it's important. I don't say this is anything, but it is important that you know. I personally, after my experience in trying to shoot an elephant,
the one you in Africa,
led me into a waterless area on his own initiative. Never drank any water at all. Daylight or night in Tobruk. I drank half a pint of tea in the morning and half a pint of tea in the evening.
Now, why was that? What was your thinking?
I thought an occasion might arise at some time or other in the desert when it would be amazingly advantageous to me if I could do without water for a considerable length of time. Even then, I thought.
So it was in preparation. You were thinking of the future.
Yes. And yet I didn't. So we're here now.
And did you have a mess? Or was it just this tent you shared, you know, a tent with ceiling?
Well, there was no mess. There was a command car that the colonel sat in. His adjutant sat behind him. If I wanted to write a letter to my wife, I sat behind him with whoever else had to be who was sitting in the car.
Would you write often?
Yes, if there was any possibility of it being sent to Cairo.
And did she write similarly as often as possible?
Yes, she did. I didn't often get a letter in November.
Now, one thing, what about the dive bomb attacks? What do you remember of them?
Now, I remember the dive bomb attacks with the greatest clarity. They arrived punctually from Crete. They consisted of 10 to 12 dive bombers. They circled round the gun positions, which they couldn't possibly mistake, although they were covered with camouflage nets. And then one after another, they came straight down onto the position. And what men were not in slit trenches were killed, especially if they took fright and ran about. They were devastating and very frightening. And they happened every day at 10 and at 4 o'clock. And they were very punctual, so you knew exactly when they were coming.
Did you have any close escapes yourself?
Very.
Do you remember any of them, or
yes,
what it was like?
Three bombs from one attack in the morning fell on the side of the hill between the shotgun or Celia's car and the escarpment. They started to roll down the escarpment. One went off. I shouted to everybody, jump out and jump into a handbag little square that we had made purposely for this purpose, and lie down. And anybody running about, I shouted at him, lie down. The second one went off below the colonel's car. And the third one ran up against the sandbagging emplacement and didn't go off, which I was just lying in. That's my experience.
So you were lucky.
Yeah.
Any others? Any other close escapes?
No.
Did the battery suffer much? Many casualties from dive bombers?
Yes. Wasn't a single cross in the land. The Armagh is a cemetery when I reached in Tobruk. And when we left Tobruk, there were over 1,000.
Not from the from the garrison, you mean?
Oh, from the garrison.
Yeah. Not from the south, not to Tsars, obviously.
No, I mean, they never really large number from the south to the south. Because continued dive bombing twice a day. Lost two or three casualties every attack. And I always found that when I went to the gun position as soon as I could, during and after a bomb attack, the Padre was always there first.
But you seem a bit mixed about the Padre. You sort of admire him but didn't get on too well.
I mean, what was he? Well with him. I admired him enormously.
Did you get on with him as well?
Very well.
What was he like, I mean, to talk to?
He came in, he asked me if he could have a church session. And I said, no, and not under any circumstances can you have a collection of men in the evening which could be dive bombed and you might lose 1,000 casualties. But what you can do, Padre, is you can walk about until you can find a large cave. And if you can find that, you can certainly hold any religious functions that you wish. And we'll make a rope ladder for men to climb down into this. And he found a large bier. A bier is where they used to keep the corn. As this part of Africa was a corn center for the Mediterranean. And they made a very large hole dug by hand. And when the corn was ripe, they filled this with corn. And they filled and they put a round stone at the top, which fitted exactly, so that nobody else could know where it was except one of the people who had put the corn inside. And those were called beers, and they were used continuously in the early ages He found one in Tobruk, and we held Sunday services in the morning, and he had communion, and he held evening services.
Do you think his activities were good for morale?
Excellent. He was extremely well liked and admired enormously.
What about
the reason he was admired was because he was always, as I say, first. But even before me, in any place where action was taking place and men were dying. I'll tell you later on when I last saw him.
What about yourself? I mean, did you suffer from nerves under fire? You seem to have not been troubled too much by it.
Not at all. I had a great deal to do, and I had a great deal of men to look after. And what I did, and where I went, was discussed and seen by and followed by every man there. And had I sat in the hole for the siege of Tobruk, it would have lasted a very much shorter time.
So you saw it, you had to set an example.
That's right.
Were you nervous, sir, under fire?
Not in the least. I had a big room to do an everything important thing. And that took me all my time to look after the men that I had surrounding.
Do you think being busy helped you help stop you being nervous, or were you just not nervous by nature?
Of course I was. Well, I was very tough. But I'm quite sure I was nervous and frightened as anybody else. But there wasn't anything to do about it, because where the danger was, that is where there were more wounded who required my attention.
What did you think of Finnegan, the doctor?
I thought he was. I liked him very much. He was amusing. He was terribly afraid that all the girls in England would be married before he got back. And he tried to persuade me to send him back to Cairo on some pretext or other. After a few months, indeed, I did do so. And he went to the London Scottish, where he got drunk on Halloween. And he met the matron in the main passage of the hospital. And he brought her to her knees to rape her, which he very strongly disliked, and she knocked him out, and he went back to England. He was an amusing chap.
So, anything else about this time? What about, were you bored at all, or were you too busy to be bored? A lot of the men...
Terribly bored, so you'd be doing nothing else. I filled my day as best I could. Now, it happened that the powers that be sent up some holes.
Towards the end of the siege?
Yes.
Hang on, let me just ask you something else. You organised what they called the bush artillery, according to the captured Italian guns.
Yes.
What do you remember about organising that? And what?
There
what
400 Italian guns in a park. All parked together. They were all made by Vickers, and there were masses of artillery shells. I took all these guns and put them as near the perimeter as possible. And when I fired my guns, I fired these guns, so that the Italians couldn't know which shells came from which guns, and upset them to such an extent that they didn't reply in the end. When the shells from the Tobruk garrison came over into their positions, they simply took shelter in their slip trenches because they couldn't make out which guns were firing. In the end, there were 400 guns there, and I fired a lot until every single one blew up.
The other reason was there was a shortage of ammunition as well. British ammunition, yes. I mean, in some sense. Oh, was that another reason for using the...
Yes.
Certainly. But they sound as if they were dangerous to use if they kept blowing up. I mean...
Not particularly. Guns do blow up, but they don't do too much damage. They might, sometimes one blows up the wrong way and blows the breech out and kills a couple of men. Otherwise, you blow the spout off.
But it was worth it for the effect they had.
I thought so.
Now, one thing that happened was quite unusual at Tobruk was they built... The Italians had already had sort of 20, 30-foot pole OPs, forward OPs, on the front line, which you took over. But they also built some scaffolding.
That's right.
Did you have anything to do with that? What was the thinking behind them?
It was impossible for us in... Tobruk, to see where our shells fell, because there was a low ridge outside the perimeter wire behind which the Italians had dug in all their guns, and they had dug them in very well because they're extremely good mechanical diggers. With the result that we could never tell whether our shells that we were firing were hitting anything or nothing, and they mostly hit nothing. So I built a tower with poles with the help of
Royal Engineers.
Poles who were very handy at all those sort of things. And I've got two, I think, but one was the best. And I sighted it very carefully so that the bottom of it was in a hollow. And curiously enough, on the siege ended, I picked up a map, one of the artillery officers, and this map was crisscrossed with lines. They've been trying to find the bottom of tower to knock it down. They've been unable to do it because by chance I sighted it on purpose in a hollow.
And did you ever go up the tower?
Of course I did. I went up daily.
What sort of a view did you get from up there?
Not very good. But I couldn't see their guns, and I couldn't see their gun emplacements. And I kept one of the Southern Officers, FOOs, up in one of these towers, which was well back from the front line, all the time, in case he could fly and see anything happening on outside the perimeter. Now, it was very easy for the Germans and for the Italians to see people climbing up and down these towers. So I arranged for an arm to be put out like that at the top, and from that I put camouflage nets down to the bottom. So it was impossible for anybody to see another person at any distance, anybody climbing up into it. Well, they had their uses. And one day Captain Hingston, H-I-H-S-T-O-N, Hingston of Burke's battery, was up in the tower, and a young cavalry officer who got stranded in the brook and was brought to tears asked if he could go up and spend the day up in the tower to see what he could see. I said, certainly. And it happened that the Italians opened fire on the tower, and for the first time over dozens of days, they hit the arm that was holding the camouflage net, snapped it off, and it took the head off the artillery officer, the cavalry officer. He was left lying next to Hingston, I think his name was, on the platform at the top, which is not very big. I got a telephone message to tell me that this had happened, so I got on the telephone to Hingston and told him to come down off the tower. He said he couldn't move because he was so shocked as he had the body of this man next to him. Well, I said, I'll come and get you down. So I went down, I climbed up to the top of the tower, I kicked the body, of course, of the unfortunate officer who'd been decapitated off the top. Hickson was sick, and then I said, you've got to come down. He said, I can't move. I said, don't be an idiot. And I started to get and come down, and I said, you slide over my back, put your arms around my neck, and I'll say, bring you down, which I did. and he was never asked to go up another one while he was there.
Was he actually wounded at all?
Wasn't touched. Wasn't touched. It was a fluke, but it was an unfortunate fluke. They didn't really do very much good, but they were something for somebody to do. 10 months doing nothing is very bad for everybody. That is why the troops of this particular regiment were of the highest class. It didn't matter to them that they had little or nothing to do. At various periods of the day, they knew they were going to be dive bombed in the morning and in the evening, and the rest of the day there wasn't very much for them to do. But they never, never gave up any sort of morale at all. Now, I think we can go on to the relief of Tobruk.
Just a couple more questions. You mentioned sandstorms. There are a lot of sandstorms at Tobruk.
No, very few. There were about three. And when you get a bad sandstorm, you get the sand up from the Sahara, which is red sand, and all you can do is to lie down and cover your head and wait until it's over. You can't move about, you can't walk anywhere because you can't see anything. But it didn't happen often.
Sorry, I got that. The other thing is they used to move guns, single guns or troops of guns, up to the perimeter wire of us for forward shoots. Do you recall that? Or were you involved in that?
Oh, yes, I used to superintend it. And every time we thought we'd got a target that we could shoot at, it was a little hill. And it was occupied by the Italians and well fortified, and they had a beer, which was a big cave underneath the hill, and they used to keep their troops out of danger there. And they brought a tank up there. They put the tank on the top of this little hill, and we brought the guns up to shoot at the tank. And when the tank got tired of being shot at, it went away.
What did you think of the 25-pounder as a weapon?
First-class infantry weapon, and a very unpleasant gun to be shot at. I was shot at by a battery of 25-pounders that the Germans had captured at just after halfway through Alamein, and I thought it was a very unpleasant, very accurate gun.
What was so unpleasant about it?
Because the shells burst very easily, and they burst, they did not go into the ground far. And unless you were a good 3 feet below the ground, you would be killed by the bits. But they were useless against tanks.
Right now, you wanted to move on to the breakout now. What were the preparations for the breakout? Were you involved in the briefing and the plans that were made?
Oh, yes, with the Australians. And there was an Australian commander in Tobruk. He commanded from his headquarters, which were inside a tunnel. And perfectly safe.
That most of them were British and Polish by the end. There were just a couple of half battalions or battalions.
Well, I think that some of the Australians were taken back, and they were exchanged by a British battalion whose number I can't remember, but I went down to see them, and I saw one man standing just as landed that night from a destroyer, and he was shivering and shaking. And I said, "What's the matter? Are you cold?" And he said, "No, I'm not cold. But from the moment that I put my I stepped onto this place, Tobruk, I have been so frightened that I cannot stop shivering and shaking." Well, I said, "I've been here 6 months, and I'm all right, sir. I think you'll be all right if you take a better view of the place." It's nice, the seaside, good air, and not an awful lot of danger. Whether it cheered him up or not, I don't know. I never saw him again.
Now, what about the preparations? What was the plan for the breakout, or what do you remember of the
two plans, one June the 2nd, and that was a complete failure because the officer commanding the artillery at Cairo did not take any notice of the photograph which I sent him or the fact that the Germans had got a new tank and a new gun, which was a short 75 and a Mark IV tank, and they were easily superior to all tanks we had.
Now, the real breakout came in November.
Yes.
What about the planning for that?
Planning for that didn't really concern Tobruk very much. The reason for it was that the Germans withdrew all the Panzer arrangements. And they withdrew them down a place called the Trig, which was a wide valley, and they were completely out of sight. And I went up from Tobruk in my vehicle, and I watched them going along half a mile away, and they weren't taking any notice of anybody except they were going home, going out of that part of Egypt, and they withdrew altogether. And after that, the Australians, New Zealand, the South Africans came in, a few of them, as far as El Adam, and I saw the army cars there, and I drove over there and found that they were South Africans looking for food. And I said, there's plenty of food here, there are all the German food dumps. Help themselves. And I then realized all the German armor had gone. I gave the whole of the regiment a week's leave in Cairo to go on their own at once. Within 24 hours, they were all gone. And before they went, I handed the guns over to the Poles, who said they knew how to shoot them. I said, if you don't, you better learn quickly. And when the last load of yeomanry had gone, I followed them and went down the road myself.
Now, so you don't remember in detail the assault on Tiger that Birkin's battery was supporting, and then the move out into the corridor by 426 battery towards El Duda. That's not something that you particularly remember?
No.
No, right. So the next stage was when they finished...
The equipment of the South Dalton's Arms. That happened, they had a week's leave or a fortnight's leave, and then they were sent to a camp which they made themselves in the Delta, which was just below Mina. Very nice area where they were given new tanks and they were re-equipped altogether.
That's where they got the honey tanks for the OP officers, is that what you mean?
No, I don't. I mean the Churchill tanks. Every regiment, instead of having British tanks, were given these new Churchill tanks. And the Churchill tank had the gun on the right-hand side of the tank. And there are three regiments were equipped with these, and they were trained with these, and they spent a month down in this camp, and then they went back to...
But that's not the South Knots Hussars. They were an artillery regiment.
Oh, yes, they were an artillery regiment. I don't mean that. I mean the tanks that they supported.
The Gloucestershire Yeomanry in the County of London,
yes.
3rd and 4th County London. Right. Now... there was also at this point the battery was made into the regiment was made into three batteries. 520 battery
yeah.
was created. Was there any? Do you remember anything about that or why it was done? Or
yes, it was done in the 23rd Armored Division, Armored brigade.
22nd.
22nd armored brigade. And they made three troops. Each troop was identical. They had one tank regiment, one battery, Hussars, half a dozen machine guns, if they had any luck, and a certain number of 60th or rifle brigade infantry. They had medical assistance in each one, each complete unit. But, and a very serious but, they were not